So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with your monthly digest of trends, stories, music and sex. It can only be the modern man. Here's what we've got coming up today.
My six-year-old is the avatar of my six-year-old sense. He's exactly right. As needy and tortured and kind of on an emotional roller coaster as I am.
Return of the Dads, Stuart Goldsmith and Tom Price, back to discuss video games, testosterone and triage, all in a day's work when you've got a six-year-old boy. Plus,
a mild hint of either vinegar or lemon.
Alex Fox on a new female contraceptive, and Ollie Peart is the best, best man. It's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and thanks to those of you who got in touch to offer your services to help last month's guest Vicky find her father. You know, I've always said, you never know exactly just how many hobbyist genealogists you have listening to your podcast until you ask. It turns out, quite a few of you. Thank you as well to this man fan who got in touch anonymously and says, Ollie, I've been listening for 5 years now. Keep up the good work. I'm currently 34. I've been serving in the military since I was 16. And as a 17-year-old, I did battlefield studies in France and Italy. It was sobering to see the graves belonging to troops my age and younger and see the true cost of war. So he's getting in touch, obviously, in reaction to Ollie Peart visiting the Falklands last month. He says, as Ollie said, it's not just war tourists. Troops also often go back and visit areas later in life. And my generation of current serving members went to Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times. But I fear that after the drawdown and recapture of Afghanistan by the Taliban, some guys who are seriously injured or have seen horrific things may never get that closure by visiting that part of the world again, which will only add to the feeling of resentment and waste around what was an extremely costly 20 years. Thank you for that. Thank you as well to Ross in Crawley, who, following Caitlin from Sydney's submission last month, has got in touch with a copy of his PhD thesis that thanks me in the acknowledgements. I really didn't see this coming as a meme. His one is from 2019. It is entitled Cenozoic CO2, Chance History or Inevitable Outcome? Strong title, Ross. Right old cliffhanger. And yes, it turns out that like Caitlin, he did indeed thank me in his acknowledgements. Although specifically, he thanked me and Helen Ann Martin from Answer Me This. I'm sure, Ross, if only you'd known that you'd be getting a shout out 3 years later on a different podcast of mine, you would have name checked this one instead. He says, Ollie, after my PhD, I moved to New York for my next job. I was surprised how much cultural dissonance there is for such a metropolitan city with mostly the same language. Your shows have been a portable slice of the UK throughout and helped keep me sane. So thank you, and know that many times in my PhD and subsequent postdocs would not have been nearly as enjoyable without your audio help. That is so lovely. Thank you, Ross. And if ever I come across anyone who has a gig going in the data analysis of CO2 concentrations from hundreds of millions of years ago, I will certainly put them your way. If you've ever thanked me in your PhD or intend to, do forward them through. We are keeping all of these. Perhaps we can bequeath a special man wing to the British Library in time. Or if not, an Apple Podcast review for this show will suffice. Or you can buy us a beer, send us a donation equivalent to the cost of a pint of beer, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk/beer. Stephen in County Meath has done that this month. So has Mark Edmondson, Both incredible people. Thank you. You are helping support this show. As are our sponsors, Beer 52, and thanks to them. I was watching the Commonwealth Games the other day with a beer in my hand, of course, and I was thinking, you know, probably the most athletic thing that I've done all summer is feverishly rip open my monthly case of beer when it arrives on my doorstep, because each month Beer 52 send me a case from a different part of the world. You don't know what you're going to get, and this month it was Pennsylvania. So good. There was like a vegan malty job in there called Kulsch, with a German umlaut on the letter O, like Alan Partridge's Sprint. And also, can you imagine, a watermelon ale from a brewery called Evil Genius. The beer is genuinely called Hashtag I Can't Even, which is the great thing about Beer 52. They send you delicious beers that you absolutely would choose to go out there and buy but can't find, and stuff you would frankly never think to buy but then love. They are offering you a free case of beer just for listening to this show. Head over to beer52.com/modern, cover the meagre postage cost of £5.95, and they will throw in two extra beers for free. That is 10 unique craft beers. You can choose light case, mixed case. You get a free copy of Ferment magazine, which is like tasting notes, so you can pretend you know what you're talking about, and a couple of tasty snacks, and you can pause or cancel your subscription whenever you like. It is beer52.com/modern to claim your free case now. That is beer52.com/modern. And thanks again to them. Right, in today's show, you will learn why children learn from the mortar, not the bricks. You will learn the best way to pay tribute to Marty McFly in tattoo form. And you'll learn the effect of semen on the pH range of a vagina. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist with Manscaped, your trends tested with Ollie Pitts. Summer salutations to you. You're looking... You're not looking that summery. You haven't got sunglasses on or anything. You're wearing a crisp white tee.
Who would wear sunglasses in what is effectively a Zoom call? No one.
I meanwhile, dress for summer all year round, apart from at Christmas,
yeah,
when I wear my Home Alone Christmas jumper. So, you know, I'm ideally attired for this time of year without trying. Got my Chip and Dale T-shirt on. Not Chip and Dale's the male strippers, the Disney cartoon characters.
Ah, yeah, man. Was that Alvin, Simon and Theodore? Actually,
oh,
really,
what a philistine. No, that's the Chipmunks.
Oh,
Chip,
right,
and Dale,
oh,
are the Disney ripoffs of the Chipmunks. Luckily, we're not here, yeah, to talk about Disney. We're here to test your trends. And you may recall Paul in Folkestone wrote in last month to say he's going to a whole bunch of weddings this summer. Now, I love weddings, but he does have my sympathy, because I think you want two a year, basically, don't you? One at summer, one in winter. That's my view.
Ideally, I'd have none. I've got two wedding invites this year, both of which I can't go to. And I feel a bit bad, but I'm also secretly delighted.
Because public displays of affection creep you out because you're heartless and cold.
No.
Something joyous, isn't there, about being in a multi-generational room full of people getting up and dancing?
The best bit of a wedding is the bit where you walk from there or get from there and it's the first glass of champagne when you get to the reception.
That is a good bit,
That's the best bit. And then by the time I finish that first glass, maybe a second glass, maybe had a canapé or two, I'm ready to leave.
I see your point. I would put the best bits in this order. One, the kiss when they actually get married, because like I say, you're cold-hearted. I enjoy that. Two would be the first glass of champagne, I will concede. And then the third best bit for me is the speeches. And I think this is quite divisive and at the root of this month's challenge, because Paul has challenged you to create the ultimate wedding speech. He obviously feels that wedding speeches are not a good use of his time. I personally rather enjoy the awkwardness.
That's the bit I can't stand. I cannot stand when it's like, it's so cringe. They get up and you're like, the minute they start talking, you know it's going to be shit. You're just like, no, this is that I'm not on board with this. This is going to be horrible. No one's going to laugh. No one's going to enjoy this. I don't know what they're talking about. Please stop.
When people get it wrong, what do you think they get wrong?
They try and tell jokes and they're not comedians, so they just come out wrong and they're not funny or they're too in. But there are some genuinely funny ones where people just share, you know, a story from this person that we've all got some kind of relationships with past. And you kind of, because you know them a bit, you can see the humour in it. You understand their personality and who they are and why that would be a funny thing.
Stories and experiences that feel small and insignificant to you as well might resonate with other people in the room and actually teach them about, you know, your mutual friend. I went to a wedding once where the best man stood up and told a story about how he and the groom
had been sheltering under a table during a terrorist attack in Paris and were there for like 12 hours. And that was the basis of his story. And none of us knew that our friend had been in that traumatic situation. It had never come up before. He'd never mentioned it. We were like, how is that possible? But then actually the sort of lesson from the story of the way that he behaved, both, you know, in terms that were funny and terms that were kind of emotionally significant, were really resonant. We were like, yeah, that's exactly what he'd do. You know what I mean? So you can identify things that you share about that person, which in itself brings about a kind of feeling of warmth in the room, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also I think for the person as well, like hearing how people perceive them is a really lovely thing as well in those circumstances, in those times.
I mean, have you done it before? Have you been a best man?
Yeah, I've been my brother's best man. It was incredibly formal and it was not the vibe because it was not like there was loads of people there because it was all the way in Singapore. So we had, you know, there wasn't that many people that were able to make it from the UK. So I had to keep it quite straight laced and I did break down. I did cry and I thought, no, that's tragic. And I got no sympathy at all from anyone. It was just like, oh no, he's really embarrassed himself there.
I mean, I think that's forgivable because it's your brother and quite sweet because it's your brother. Mm. I do think it's important. So I've been best man twice.
Yeah.
I aced it, I think, is a fair summary. I sort of worked out what the template was from viewing other people screw it up, basically. And the template is, first of all, start with some comments about the room you're in. Like, read the room and make a joke about them. Like, that's maybe what you didn't do in this formal setting in Singapore, I'm guessing. So you didn't undercut the formality. So I start with that, because then it feels immediately like you are sort of improvising, right? Even though you could have scripted it in advance, which makes people feel like they're watching something live. So start with that. Then basically roast the groom gently, right? So embarrassing stories, but in my view, embarrassing stories about him that happened a long time ago, so that he can still own it. Like, it's not the person he is now. It's not that he's going to, you know, walk out the marquee and shit himself now because he's so terrible with booze. It's a story from 10 years ago. And then end by hitting the emotional pedal hard. Like, at the end, it's basically, I love you and your wife's so beautiful and isn't everything wonderful and wouldn't your father be proud? That's it. Like, that's the template. Like, it's not that difficult. Those are the three steps. Why do people struggle so much with it?
Because people aren't writers like you, Ollie. I mean, you are a professional writer and broadcaster, you know? So that is something that you do and you've written jokes professionally. It is hard. And actually, if you go out on the internet, as you do, and search, you know, how to write a speech, there are so many websites and articles giving advice.
How much should I have charged for that advice I just
gave? Yeah, possibly quite a lot. Because one of the guys I stumbled across is a comedy writer. His name is Mark Blakewell, right? And he's written for, like, Radio 4, 11 O'Clock Show, Ali G Show as well. So, like, he is a professional comedy writer. And he offers his service to write your speech. And he does all wedding speeches, but predominantly best man speeches. That's sort of the thing that people go to him for the most.
How much?
So for a wedding speech,
yeah.
So this is a completely unique written speech from scratch, £359.
Okay. And that's like, presumably, so he reads your draft, does he? Suggests improvements and then sort of...
No, he will write it from scratch for that. So the way that...
From scratch? For £359 quid? Oh, that's quite a good deal, isn't it, if you're nervous?
So what he does is he has a questionnaire that he asks you to fill out so he can get an understanding of the individual, of the person. And then he will write it off the back of that. And I did actually ask him, I said, don't you just feel tempted to just chuck in like jokes that you've used, you know, before all the time? Just chuck them in. He's like, no, I do. I make every effort to make every single one completely unique to that person. He does actually offer a last minute best man speech service as well, which is more expensive. It's £399. And he told me about that, where he can turn it around in 48 hours basically. And there was one time where a guy got in touch with him at 8:30 on the morning of the wedding and needed it by midday, and he turned it around.
Lose confidence in what he had or hadn't thought about it?
Just hadn't thought about it, I think. And so he turned that around, but he did say to the guy at that point, he said, look, there's going to be jokes in here that are kind of, you know, off the rack. They're not going to be completely bespoke to you. And the guy was like, I don't care. I just need a speech. I need something. Just get it to me. But I asked him about, you know, how I should approach it. Where do I even start with this? Because I mean, as we've established, I'm terrible at... writing speeches. I break down. And my speeches weren't funny either. I don't try and be funny. So he gave me five pointers to think about when you're writing your speech. The first one is not to concentrate on what is funny.
I guess the point of each story shouldn't be the joke. but each yes. story should have a joke in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you write the thing that's important, then you think of the thing that's funny about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. He says if you try and be funny from the off, you're just going to hit a mental block. So instead, if you focus on those stories, the funny will kind of come out of that naturally. So the next thing you need to do is brainstorm. He's like, absolutely, you just got to brainstorm from the off, get it all down. And then when you've got all of that down, you need to look for links. Try and look for links between the material, stuff that you can kind of stitch together.
Yes. So it seems like a continuous narrative. Like any stand-up, right? It's actually five disparate ideas that you make all seem like they're the same point.
Yeah, exactly. But also not to get bogged down on the structure. So try not to get bogged down on that, because no one's going to be judging you on that, really. You know, just
that's wrong. That's wrong. Hit the emotional pedal hard at the end. That's it. That's the only rule.
No, he doesn't.
Say whatever you like. Take the piss, then hit the emotional pedal hard. Structure is all.
He didn't say don't focus on structure. He just said don't make that. Don't get bogged down with that. And something that you hinted at as well, try and get that first laugh in as early as possible.
Yes.
You get that in, puts everyone at ease. Your way of doing that is to talk about the room, but you can do it in whatever way you want.
Have your fly open.
Yeah, get your cock out.
Actually, don't do that would be another thing I would say. Like the thing, like referencing the stag do, I think is a no-no. Did he mention anything about that?
Yeah, and he says try and keep drinking stories to a minimum. It shouldn't be, all be about that. I mean, that is part of it, but don't make it the be-all and end-all. Try and think of some other stories that people will find interesting instead of just him getting pissed and shitting himself.
Yeah, so the worst one that I ever saw was where the best man was a really nice guy, but he did spend half of the best man speech recounting, you know, difficult episodes from the stag do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the groom's mother was there and she's a conservative Catholic. You know, it was just a bit like, oh, this is awkward. And then I was like, move on from this, tell an old story. And he did, thankfully. And you could feel the room sort of relax when he started telling a funny story about what happened at university. And the funny story from university was when his friend rushed home from the library to buy a copy of FHM with Kelly Brook on it so he could have a wank. That was the story that he told to move on the audience. I was just like, this is a car crash. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Don't do that.
You need to avoid that. And also with language as well, you just got to be really careful with that. You don't want to kind of be overly obscene. If you can avoid like foul language, that's a big win. You can still be funny without it.
Yeah.
Having said that, he does have a loose structure, and he sent me sort of these tips that he's got on his website for where you can start if you do want to try and do it DIY. And that's what I followed for this. So I thought, I'm gonna have a go at writing a bit of a speech.
Oh, you actually have written one? You've actually answered Paul's challenge directly?
I've written parts of a speech. And I thought what I'd do is write the speech as your best man.
Oh, Christ.
Like, well, no, if you were to get married now, I'd obviously be your best man, wouldn't I? Would I?
Of course.
So, start with an icebreaker. That's what you always do. So here's mine. Oh, hang on, I need to get into speech mode.
This is hard. I'm trying to imagine like what the room looks like where we are. Like, I actually got married with like 20 people at the party on the balcony of a 4-star hotel in Gibraltar. Does this still work in that context?
Let's try it. Right. Let's imagine that scenario. I step up. I'm in my suit. Yeah. I'm looking good. Nice sunshine.
The place smells overwhelmingly of petrol. It's the busiest port in Europe.
Lovely. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that, so I haven't written any of the petrol smells.
The petrol joke would be a good way in, wouldn't it? That's exactly what I'm saying.
So I'll start at the top. I'll say hello, obviously. This is my icebreaker.
Mm.
This speech is about the countless memories the groom has given us, or one of them, probably on a podcast.
Okay. I don't get the punchline. What's the joke? It's a soft in. No, but literally, what's the joke? This is about one of the memories the groom has given us on a podcast.
This speech is about the countless memories the groom has given us. All one of them. You've only given us one memory, Ollie, because you're not a very memorable man.
Okay.
That's the joke.
Yeah. Delivered professionally, that meaning would become clearer.
Yeah, I don't know why, but when I get slightly nervous and embarrassed about stuff that I'm doing, I go into like a slightly like weird voice like that. I don't know why.
I've noticed that. Yeah. You've got like an inner Chaz and Dave that comes out when you're nervous. It's really unhelpful in a broadcast there, yeah.
I don't know why I do it. I really don't know why. Anyway, so then you need to identify how you know the groom. So this is how I thought I'd get into that. And I've also on here, I've marked out where I expect people to laugh. So I'm going to just see if that works. Okay.
Good. Okay.
I remember when I first met Ollie at King's Cross Station. We were there to record a pilot episode of The Modern Man. We sat in a cafe, the only place in London you can record a podcast for the price of a coffee. Laugh. Ollie asked me if I wanted anything, and being polite and desperate to be part of his new podcast I knew nothing about, I said no. Ollie, on the other hand, hungry from a previous recording, as he usually is, went straight in with some calamari.
Okay. You get a laugh of identification there, I think.
Complete with aioli dip. Anyone who enjoys a creamy ring is all right with me, I thought. I knew we'd be friends forever.
Yeah. I mean, the task was to create the ultimate wedding speech, and I'm not sure a joke about creamy arseholes would qualify in the template, but I think it's the best you've got so far. That could be lifted into a best man speech, yes.
Yes, it, yeah.
It's very specific.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it has to be, doesn't it? It has to relate to the person that you're talking about. Okay.
I mean, I'd forgotten those details. I'd forgotten that I'd had calamari and aioli at our first meeting. That's an antisocial thing of me to have done. I mean, that stinks.
Yeah. It's very cocksure, that. It was kind of like, I've never met this person before. Fuck it, I'm going to get some calamari and some aioli.
I suppose what I was thinking is, I know that my body needs lunch. I don't know that I need to meet Ollie Pitt. So let's do the thing that I definitely need, and then, you know, everything else is a bonus. I'm not wasting my time.
Yeah. Then you get onto the main bit of the speech. I've said, for those of you who don't know Ollie, pop onto iTunes and check out his podcast back catalogue. You'll get the gist.
Okay, that's okay. That's all right. Yeah, fine. Yes. Yeah.
And then you get onto the heartfelt lines about friendship. That's the bit that you said. You push that
emotional pedal hard.
That hard.
Is hard.
This is my attempt.
Make me cry that. Now. Go on.
Okay.
Yeah.
wait.
Oh, he's nervous. I'm beginning to well up already.
Oh, I'm sweating. Yeah. I've got a sweaty chest. Uh-huh. I have everything to thank Ollie for. And that's no understatement. His low-end celeb status and UK podcasting cachet has opened doors for me I never thought could be opened. It's my fault they were slammed in my face again. But Ollie and his soothing tones have carried me on their waveform more than I'd like to fully admit. I love you, man. With two ends.
With two ends, right. So you've got the joke and you've hit the emotional pedal hard. Well done. That's good. I could imagine after a few drinks that there'd be some moist eyes.
Yeah. Not from sweat, from the Gibraltar sun.
Now, what you haven't done, though, which I think is probably also like imperative, is mention the lady I'm marrying.
Well, no, all I've got is complimentary lines about the bride.
Yeah.
And I've just put...
Don't say that out loud. Insert complimentary line about the bride.
Well, that would be funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That'd be great. And then just moving on swiftly would be lovely.
I think you'd have to be genuine friends with the bride to be able to do that.
Yes. Yeah, you would.
And also, I think the bride would actually have to be drop-dead stunning. Because that's the other thing, isn't it? Like, the thing you're supposed to say, even though it feels like a thing from the 70s, the only thing you absolutely have to say is, doesn't the bride look amazing? And then everyone claps, right? So if you're making a joke that you're not saying that, then I think you can only do that joke on the basis that everyone can clearly see the bride is beautiful. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
If the bride was unconfident in herself, that wouldn't be a good joke to make.
Well, I've made it quite throwaway. I didn't want to draw too much attention to it, so I've just said, you're of course looking wonderful tonight.
Okay, you're of course looking wonderful tonight.
And then straight onto the toast.
Right.
So I'd be like, to Ollie, man.
Yeah.
And his wife.
Yeah, that gets a cheer, doesn't it, at a wedding, even though, again, feels actually quite old and sexist now.
So it's not the ultimate best man speech. It's not the ultimate speech. It's not the ultimate anything, really.
No, it passed some time, didn't it? I don't think you embarrassed yourself.
But what I think I have identified is that actually writing a speech is really quite difficult. It is very, 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 very hard, actually, to do it well. I know you've said you found it easy and you absolutely nailed it.
I didn't say I found it easy. I said I don't understand why people find... like interpreting the template difficult. Like, it seems obvious to me what the elements are. I'm not saying doing them is easy.
Yes, but you do it day in, day out. You know, like, if this is not something, you know, if you sell cars for a living, you're not going to necessarily know how to structure and put together a well-articulated, brilliant speech that's going to sort of go through your life's history with this individual and tell it in a nice way.
Yeah, okay.
Are you? You're going to find it hard.
No, but what I'm saying is, if you keep in mind the really simple elements, you sort of can't get it wrong. That's the thing. People are very sympathetic, aren't they? You don't have to deliver it brilliantly. You just need to know that you're going to the right place.
Yeah, but this is the thing, isn't it? That actually, that the pressure that's put on people these days to deliver... on a best man speech especially, But all speeches, to be honest, but a best man speech is huge. It's a really massive thing. It's a really big deal. And being asked to do it is obviously a lovely thing as well. So you want to make sure you do it right. And when I was speaking to Mark, he was saying to me, look, I've had more and more people coming to me asking for this service more than ever. If I wanted to, I could do this 7 days a week.
Yeah.
It could be his full-time job if he wanted to. So
we have unearthed a genuine trend in Paul's speculative trend that there are more weddings than there used to be because of lockdown.
Yeah, but it's that pressure and that expectation on that speech to deliver something that a professional comedy writer would find hard to do. Yeah. So you're asking just somebody to go up on a stage in front of people and make them laugh. And it's hard. So no wonder people are looking for this service to do that now.
All right, let's move on to your challenge for next month, Ollie. Are you hungry? Are you excited to know what it is?
Always.
That's right. It's from Sarah in Norwich, who says, an alarming amount of my friends are into astrology.
Right, okay.
It started as a bit of a joke, but now they are really into it. Can Ollie learn the ways of astrology and reassure me that it is all nonsense?
It is funny, though, isn't it? Because actually, with those star signs, one of the things I find... I mean, if I find one of those free newspapers lying about in a train when I'm heading into London, I will pick it up. And for some weird reason, I will go straight to the bit with the star sign, read it. And
just, do you?
Yeah.
I just find the whole thing so unsavoury, I can't even bring myself to read it.
I mean, I'd be intrigued to meet one of the people that writes it. It can't be based on anything.
Well, I'd like
you
to make some genuine inquiries as to how it works. Because presumably if you're a published astrologer, then you are claiming that it's real and you should be able to take a call from the media asking about it, right?
They have to be able to defend it, don't they? If it's in the stars.
I don't know, because it's like psychics, isn't it? There's Psychic Sally is appearing at my local arts centre soon. I haven't seen a poster, I just had a vision. No, I have seen a poster. And at the bottom of the poster, it says, this evening is purely for the purposes of entertainment. You know, i.e. she's not really claiming to be a psychic, even though quite clearly she is claiming to be a psychic and that would be the entertainment of the evening. So there's always this weird, like, legal get-out clause, isn't there?
Yeah, and maybe... I mean, I've always sort of seen it a little bit like fortune cookies. Exactly that. It's just a bit of fun, isn't it, around the dinner table? And it's the same with it's the same with star signs in the back of a paper.
Well, I'd be curious to know if you start genuinely, like, finding out what it's like to learn astrology, what it all means, and whether you think there is anything in it. And also, I guess, the burgeoning trend that there appears to be. I mean, I don't know how old you are, Sarah, but I know that, like, there's a thing for sort of 30-something women, basically, isn't there, in astrology at the moment.
I can't say I've noticed it, to be honest, but I'll look into it.
I look forward to it, Ollie. In the meantime, we should thank, as ever, our sponsors, Manscaped.com.
Yeah, because if you didn't know, Ollie, this summer is smooth sack summer. So when you're playing in the summer,
is it sun, yeah, smooth it is. Sack summer, there's a thing. Yeah. I'd heard about the platinum jubilee.
This is the platinum puberly.
Hey,
yeah, see what I did there?
You can write your own puns.
Hint of Alex Fox just right there. This is the summer that you want to keep your balls cool. And actually, I don't know about you, but having sweaty balls in the summer is actually quite disgusting, so giving them a good old shave is lovely. You can dive head first into smooth sack summer by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping with our code MAN. That's MANN.
You can use their excellent hardware to trim your balls, but also you can use it on your other body hair, which I did just before I went on holiday, because I just do not feel very confident about... I've got hair that's not just like... You know, you get that bit above your ass crack. I've got hair there, like on the bottom of your back.
Yeah.
Don't like that. Mm. But also I've got hair, like chest hair I'm kind of okay with, but it was very bushy. And also hair, like on the back of my shoulders, really rank, like werewolf type hair on the back of my shoulders.
Yeah.
I couldn't reach it all, so I got my wife to shave it off for me in the garden, like a sheep. And on holiday in the beaches of Argelès-sur-Mer,
yeah,
I felt substantially more confident and I got a better tan. Thanks, Manscaped. Try it for yourself. Go to manscaped.com and use our code MANN to get 20% off plus free shipping. Ollie Pitt. See you next month in Smooth Sack September.
See you next month.
In a moment, Tom and Stu return to the podcast. 1 year on, it's How to Be a Dad, Part 8. But first, it's our record of the month, and it's this charming Harry Styles-ish jam from Lauv, L-A-U-V. It's called Stranger. It's off his new album, All for Nothing, and our playlist, modernman.co.uk/music.
So what if this is it? What if it falls apart in front of my face? I wouldn't be surprised, 'cause it happens every time.
and now I'm feeling sick. Doing all these things that just push you away. Baby, tell me why. Do I do this every time?
It is that time of year again, our annual How to Be a Dad special. We've been doing this for 8 years, so if you are new to the show, don't worry, you will be able to follow what's happening. It is essentially just three middle-aged men talking about their kids. But if you would like to start from the beginning and enjoy the soap opera quality of these annual conversations, then you can. Just visit modernman.co.uk/dads, and you can stream or download all of the previous 7 installments there and see what we've already discussed over the years. But basically, back in 2015, my friends, the comedians Tom Price and Stuart Goldsmith, eerily found out that, like me, they were each about to have a son at Christmas time. And every year since, we've caught up to discuss the latest trials and tribulations of our fatherhood journeys and share tips on how to be a modern dad. So, part 8. It's 2022. Our boys are now 6 years old. Stuart's boy now has a younger sister. Mine now has a younger brother. Tom's boy always had an older brother. And I don't know about you, but I remember when I was 6, and what I really, really wanted and got for my 7th birthday was a Sega Master System. So I wanted to start this year's chat by comparing notes on video games. Are our kids ready?
He's got a little Amazon iPad, and he plays on that a lot. Plays Minecraft, which is basically, you know, Lego.
It's 3D Lego.
It's 3D Lego.
And we're just on Minecraft. I was in the States with a friend of mine, and my friend was playing Minecraft with his son back in Wales and his son's mum, and the whole family play it together, and it was this awesome, like, this is what future computer games is going to be supposed to be like.
So exactly. So several points about this. First of all, the way that I initially rationalised the entry into the computer games world was by saying it's fine if you play with them, and I really stand by this. If you go and play Mario Kart, and I'm sitting with my boy and we're chatting and we're playing Mario Kart, I don't believe a molecule of damage is being done, right? The damage comes from repetitive hours and hours of use, and also the addictiveness. And we all read the studies about how it's like they're on heroin. What it's doing to their brains in terms of the chemical lift they get from these computer games is absolutely terrifying, right? And you know, there's this, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but there's this story that goes around that if you go to Silicon Valley, do you know this?
All the dads have frozen their children off their tablets.
That has some substance. There's lots of people who say that's the case.
The people who design the stuff know it's bad for their children.
They don't consume their own product. So that's one thing to bear in mind. So this is going to waver between good, bad, good, bad, good, bad, which, you know, that's kind of parenting, right? Constantly going, that's good, but that's bad, but that's good, but that's bad. So they really, really enjoy it. The thing that depresses me is when we do have a iPads down state, often born out of a tantrum because it's so addictive, things go wrong, and my eldest especially, who's nearly, you know, he's getting pre-teeny now, so he really flares up. When we do go no iPads, they get a cardboard box and they play with that. They draw a thing on the side of a box and they do the most beautiful, wholesome 1950s stuff, and Beth and I just sit there going, oh, shit. This is the first time we've seen our kids being themselves, and for the last week, you know, they've been brought up by Minecraft. So it's I'm really torn to with the whole thing, but we are where we are.
I think delay it as long as possible is the approach we've taken. So it seems like an inevitability because all the other kids are into it that at some point they're going to do it.
That's a big thing.
But it's not going to let it happen later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we've got into, like, now that my eldest is 6 1/3, we don't really judge things like that, but that's roughly how old he is.
I was about to, as we always do on this podcast, whenever the first person mentions the age, I'm always so close to going, no way!
Why is it funny coincidence.
So he is now old enough to play proper fun games with, and we've got a local, like, so we have you and me time. So there's bath time, and then the routine is we do bath time, and then we do stories together as like one or both parents and both children. Mm-hmm. And then my son has you and me time, and then recently my 3-year-old, she has now demanded a slice of you and me time. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of concurrent. So he is now old enough that during You and Me time, we can play actual games. We can play Dobble. We can play Junior Labyrinth, which is a fantastic board game. We've played a game called Cat Rescue. That's some Kickstarter-type conceptual game about a cat shelter, which he loves. And what's the other one? I'm going to get him back into Carcassonne, which I tried when he was three, but it was too early. But you can
that's quite early for Carcassonne.
Yeah, but you play Kid Carcassonne, where you take away the meeples and it's just a game of building castles.
Oh, I suppose. That's a jigsaw game.
This is quite a deep cut if you're not into board games.
But it touches on something that a lot of people relate to, I think, which is when you've got a younger one, how do you make time to do stuff that only the older one can
do?
Because we do this with crafts. Yeah. Like, he likes building things, sort of little miniature forest gardens out of old, pot plants and bits of newspaper and whatever. And we just can't, because the younger one will come along and throw it on the floor.
I know.
So I feel like he is missing out on that. I don't know how to carve out
this
time
problem
for that.
This problem is solved for us, but in a way that's quite painful. My youngest doesn't need to play with anyone. She's fiercely independent. She's just like, I'm playing, go out the room.
Right.
Okay, so there's no problem.
Second child syndrome. My second child, who is the same age as your eldest, he will take himself off with an iPad quite often, and he'll go upstairs and play Minecraft by himself. He'll close the door to his room.
Yeah, but doesn't he want to get involved?
No, he's weirdly independent as well, like your second. There's a second child thing, which is like, I believe it comes out of this idea that and he's like this socially, my eldest is very outward. He wants to, he'll get along with anyone. He'll start playing football with anyone. He'll have conversations with anyone. My youngest is like, my troop has always been here. My gang, my posse, my entourage, right? It's always existed. I just appeared in this family that was there. I have this unit. Mm. So why do I want anyone else? He's just very secure. And he's like, I've got my family. So it's fine. Whereas my eldest, I always have the sense that he's going, somebody love me. Can't imagine where he got that from.
This is it. I've been saying on stage, my six-year-old is the avatar of my six-year-old son. He really is. He's exactly as needy and tortured and on an emotional roller coaster as I am. And his little sister is completely self-contained and resilient.
To get into a bit of therapy here, does that make you feel better about your neediness and all
No, I feel like I've done it to him.
Fine, okay. that makes sense. But I do see a lot, and there's an ADHD conversation here, which I know everyone's having ADHD
for sure.
At the moment. I've got it. I've been diagnosed with it.
Have you?
Yeah, I'm now medicated for it, which is amazing.
Okay.
And my eldest absolutely has not been diagnosed with it, but he undoubtedly has it. So to see these things in him, baked in, I'm like, fine. I hated myself for what you've got. You're not going to have that problem.
That is really lovely. Okay, so this might become... Obviously, we're comedians, and all comedians have ADHD,
well,
and it
I was
will make
say,
more sense later in life, 20 years from now, when we look back and go, oh yeah, all comedians had ADHD.
Of course
we did. We prioritised novelty and being in a different place every night. I do not have a diagnosis, but I've ticked all the boxes to a hilarious extent, and I've half decided not to get a diagnosis, and half I genuinely keep forgetting to get around to it.
Honestly, mate, the first email I got, from a psychiatrist, the things I had to do... Yeah. In order to go to the first meeting, I had to find old reports from school. I had to get people to fill in forms. I had to read a 25, 30-page document. It took me a year. It was a year gone. It's hilarious.
I think of it as my busy brain. So it doesn't have an official title. I'm just aware that my brain's a bit busier than some people, and that's good in some ways and bad in others. As it pertains to parenting, I absolutely recognise that he is... flighty like I am, and other words like that, which probably there's some connection between. It's not a problem for him at all. He's a very high achiever at school, and he's a very a sociable, happy kind of kid. But I do think being aware of one's own flaws, in inverted commas, and recognising them in one's child, exactly that, of being able to go, I'm a bit more aware of this than my parents were when I was undergoing these things. I mean, so just even in kind of the negotiations between oneself and one's co-parent about... do we need to get on him about this? Is he being deliberately obtuse about this? Is he being deliberate? Is he ignoring us? And I'm looking at, she's getting furious because he's ignoring her. And I'm like, he's not ignoring you. He's not purposefully ignoring you. He doesn't know you're talking to him because he's away with the fairies. I've spent a lot of time away with the fairies, and I know what it looks like.
Yeah, and this is identical. And I end up becoming his sort of backer. I'm like his lawyer, when these things happen. It's exactly the same. Why do I have to call for you six times? And I'm like, because he's got the thing, that's his. And you're right to think of, busy brains. Another great thing is to call it a superpower. So I called it to my eldest. We went to a theatre show in January. And in the second half, I've got, you know, the two boys. I've got the 9-year-old. And
by not naming the show, we're now all thinking you see Jerusalem. Please tell us what it was.
Yes, Henry VIII Part 2. And they just got a bit bored. He was yawning, rude. No, we went to see Hamilton.
Right. Wow. Which, you know, okay. I mean, there's a whole separate conversation about kids and theatre, but Hamilton, interesting choice. We'll park it, but carry on.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the first half is a bit more war-y and interesting. The second half, very much sort of admin and setting up a country. Part one, let's have a fight. But in the first half, they were fine. The second half, my youngest was bored. You know, it was difficult for him, but he sort of sat like that and watched it. My eldest really struggled. I mean, to the point where people behind, it looked like he had, you know, significant learning difficulties. He was really fidgeting. I'm not taking it seriously. His arms were going up in the end. He couldn't help it.
I'm laughing at your embarrassment, Tom.
Yeah, well, that was quite funny because I was looking at Beth going, you know, at one stage Beth had to pin his arms down and stuff, and it got a bit eggy, but it was okay in the end. And afterwards,
you thought, why the fuck did I bring children to the theatre? That's not going to happen again.
Yeah, well, that
anyway,
was one
carry
thing.
On.
That cost a fortune.
We'll go back to that. Yeah.
That cost a fortune. But I thought, I'm going to get emotional here, I thought I would have got really badly told off for that when I was a kid. And I got chunks torn out of me for that. And I got to turn to him and say, that's just your thing. That's just you. Don't worry about it.
And how did he react to that?
It's fine. You couldn't give shifts. Just moving on to the next thing.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Like, you're getting emotional recounting that because you're thinking about how you would have been treated as a kid.
Oh, yeah, it's all about me. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. No, I am.
And you're trying to be a different kind of parent.
Yeah.
And yet, that Larkin thing of they fuck you up, your mum and dad.
Yeah.
We are all fucking up our children in some way we don't comprehend, and only they will be able to tell us in 30 years when they're doing a podcast series about us. And
yes.
What do you think that is? So, like, you're both saying you understand what your parents did wrong and what you're doing differently to treat them in the way they're like you.
Of course.
But then what
we're
is
missing
it that
all the stuff.
You're missing something completely because they're not you. They're different, aren't they?
They learn from, and this is my clever thing, I think I came up with this, is they learn from the mortar, not the bricks. You make all this attempt to give them the brick. This is how you do it. And what they learn from is the way you're putting the bricks down and collecting them together. They don't learn. They don't listen to any of the actual lessons.
Yeah.
So absolutely right. Yeah, but
and,
but hold, it is
and your mortar is that you're anxious and overanalyze things and worry about stuff, right?
In this analogy, I would say, no, I would say that's a brick. I would say that's me saying to them, hey, listen, you don't need to be anxious. You don't need to worry about stuff. Last night, we had an hour-long saga because he had a splinter in his finger. He's really pain phobic. And I was trying to explain to him, not only do we have to do this, huge wail and everything, but also the longer we don't do it, the more of a problem it'll become. It'll heal over. It's already started getting a bit infected because you wouldn't let me do it last night. And I tried to explain to him in kind of big visual emotional terms, this is like the pain is down here, it's this much pain, and it's this much a wobbler that you're having. It's this much a big emotional scared thing. And you're suffering so much more from all the fear and the worry than you will do from the actual tiny amount of pain while I pull it out. So that would be a brick. The mortar that he'll be learning from is something I don't even know yet about the means with which I'm telling him that. Like, I'm giving him these bricks of, hey, listen, emotional intelligence and being aware that things are scary and you can cope with that. In the meantime, he'll be accidentally learning something I'm not aware of. Like, he'll end up being bad with money because it never came up and we never talked about it, but he just saw me be bad with money. Do you know what I mean? So I'm making a definite effort to give him lessons, but he'll be learning from the other stuff I'm doing as I'm trying to read out my big important lesson. He'll be learning from the way I'm standing or the way I'm, you know.
Yeah.
They say the sign of a good analogy is when it requires 5 minutes explanation.
I'm weirdly jealous hearing you both talking about identifying with your sons, though. Because for me, he's my father, who unfortunately is no longer here, rather than me. He's not like me.
Really?
He's like my dad.
That's interesting.
And so I sort of know how to deal with him, because I knew how to deal with my dad, but my dad was 35 years older than me, not 35 years younger than me.
In what way? What sort of traits?
Oh, I mean, for example, what we did this weekend, and this is one of the great things, like, you can learn from your kids too, yeah? So one of the things we did this weekend is we went to a steam and tractor show. Now,
he loves it.
It was so hard for me to identify with what he was loving. Both he and his brother are fascinated by, like, antique tractors, combine harvesters, ponies,
There's this whole nerdy model train community who like build Playmobil figures that are powered by steam that do nothing, just sit in a field. They all come around and go, "Great engine." I can't relate.
And you've done nothing.
Nothing. I've encouraged it because it's his interest, but I've done nothing to plant that seed because I am not interested and I don't have that kind of brain.
And very sadly, your father hasn't been there to do it. So it's just...
just completely innate. Yeah, yeah. But actually, I feel... I wouldn't go as far as say, like, alienated. I'm learning about the model train community through his interest. But it's not something I can relate to. It's the opposite of looking at him and thinking, I remember being like that.
Good for you, Ollie, for going along with it. I don't think it's going to happen with my son. May yet happen with my daughter, but if one of them gets into sport, I'm going to have to go along with it in the way that you're having to go along with a model railway thing, you know, because you support their interests and you roll your eyes and you try not to... You know, we have a rule with songs. You listen to songs, they are obsessed with what I now realise are this whole wave, this whole genre of laser-guided at the 3 to 6 year old market.
Baby Shark.
Sample-based, sort of Baby Shark, but like post-Baby Shark and Baby Yoda. I don't know if you've heard the Where's Me Chicky Nuggies song.
Please, I haven't had to encounter that yet.
Oh, my God. But we had a really good conversation about respecting each other's musical choices. He told me off, and he was right. He said, "Look, I like it." And I was like, okay, you're right. I shouldn't make fun of something you like. I should respect that you like it.
But what I find interesting about this is finding fertile ground upon which to bond with them, right? Mm. And that will... That's why sports are really helpful for me, and certainly my eldest, and increasingly my youngest.
Do they support the same team as you?
Yeah.
Which is?
Liverpool.
Did they have any choice?
Yeah, actually a bit. Not really. But so Wilfred took his first steps on the old Liverpool stadium, and on the old ground, which is now...
By choice.
Yeah, they had choice.
Daddy, I wish to walk now. Find me an appropriate ground.
We were playing on Highbury Square, it's called. We were playing there, and that's when he first walked. And so, really, he should be an Arsenal fan. But I'm a massive Liverpool fan, and this coincided almost perfectly, almost to the date, with Jurgen Klopp arriving at Liverpool, who plays big, sexy, exciting rock and roll football, right? And it's the glamour and excitement and fun of that football meant that for me to say to my son, "I'm watching Liverpool, watch this with me," was much more interesting than watching a slightly broken Arsenal, as they've been over the last few years. So to say to a kid, much like in the same way in the 90s everyone became a Man United fan, he's become a Liverpool fan because they are one of pretty much the best team in the world.
Glory Hunter, we used to call it in the playground.
That's right, yeah. And he is, he's grown up, luckily I've supported them since 1989, so it's fine. But it means we've just got this... Gosh, I mean, it means we've got less to talk about. Like, you know, whenever something's happening, I can say, looks like Nunez is coming. Who's Nunez? Let's look him up on YouTube together and we watch some footage of him. And he's amazing at football, my eldest. And so I get to go and watch him. And there's no greater pleasure.
That does sound good.
Watching my son play football is the greatest pleasure I've ever experienced in my life.
I had something similar the other day when I put on Master of Puppets by Metallica and my 3-year-old started air drumming naked.
Oh, that's good.
She genuinely was into it on her own. I was like, this is amazing. Not that I'm mega into Metallica, but I do know that song and I'm like, oh, this is a thing that she's into.
It's really life affirming when that happens. I never thought... Because I quite like rugby at school, I guess, and I've always liked golf, but I've never been a big sporty kind of guy. I'm not a, you know, sports dad at all. I hated cricket. I hate team sports culture at university. I hated all the teams drinking everywhere. They're just vile. Not my thing at all.
But if he'd hated Liverpool, you would hate him. To be clear.
It's interesting that a 4-year-old understands the concept of a deal breaker. And now he knows.
Still to come, Tom and Stu talk growth spurts, morning routines, and party bags. That's when the modern man returns after this. Man fans, summer is here. It's official. And whatever you've got planned, whether it's on the beach, a city break, work or play, Stitch Fix is here to make sure that your wardrobe is perfect for all occasions. They send someone, an actual human, out to shop for you. Someone who knows your size, what you do and don't like to wear, and how much you like to spend on each item. Stitch Fix, quite simply, take the pain out of shopping for clothes. The outfits then arrive at your door a few days later. You get to try everything on at home, decide what to keep, and then send anything else back. It's so easy. You pay just £10 each time you order, which is credited towards the items you keep, and you'll get 20% off when you keep all 5 items. There's no subscription required, plus shipping, returns, and exchanges are easy and free. To get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/man to set up your profile, and then they'll deliver clothes chosen just just for you in your taste, size and budget. That's stitchfix.co.uk/man, M-A-N-N, for 20% off when you keep all five items in your fix.
Man fans, let's talk about skin. You probably already moisturise. It's the 21st century, after all. But do you scrub? Do you exfoliate? Do you cleanse, hydrate and protect? Have you ever thought about actually doing something about those circles under your eyes? If you're the kind of guy who wants to look your best, but perhaps would feel embarrassed talking about this stuff in a department store, or you don't have the time to start searching for products online, well, Tiege Hanley make it easy. They'll send you a selection of their excellent lotions and potions that really do feel great on your face. Trust me, I've tried it. And because Tiege Hanley is sponsoring today's episode, they're offering you a great deal. Just go to tiege.com/man and you'll get 30% off your first box, plus a free gift. That's tiege.com/MANN. That's an amazing deal.
Back to How to Be a Dad Now, my annual chat with fellow dads and fellow podcasters Tom Price and Stuart Goldsmith. We've all got six-year-old boys, but do we have daily routines in common as well? In this section, I wanted to discuss if there was a way to keep our daily childcare feeling fresh.
One of the things I've noticed is that I have to unlearn the kind of grunting, oh God, it's the morning. I suppose my wife has insomnia, so like, I'll do the morning. No, we alternate, but I tend to do more of them. I'll do the morning, oh God, because I remember home time and holiday time where the morning is a colossal pain in the ass because it's so different to what I was used to and everything else. And now I have to remind myself, no, mornings are brilliant. Mornings are great. Mornings are, you get the kids for 2 hours before they go to school.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because when they come back from school, they're knackered, or you know, playgroup, whatever. My son comes back from school, he's knackered, he wants cartoon time. Very quickly, we get into bath time and bedtime.
How much do you love that routine? I love that routine. Coming into land. Oh, it's exhausting and it's infuriating, don't get me wrong. Like,
I think we're all better. I enjoy more, and I think the kids are more sparky and awake in the morning bit. So I prefer, I still find bath time a bit of a pain.
I think it matters that we're talking in the summer. Like, 5 o'clock in the summer is fine because they can go in the garden. 5 o'clock in the winter and you've still got 2 hours before they're asleep is really hard.
My point stands. I love the mornings. And the point is, in terms of a transition, I'd really got in a 5-year groove of going, oh, Christ, mornings, okay, guys. And now it's completely flipped. And I'm like, this is brilliant. If I ping awake at 6:30, I'll bounce out of my bed and let my wife have a lie in so that I can go and do them because they're really good value.
I mean, that's very inspirational. Nice idea. It's a nice thing to aspire to. I was like noting my own script today as I was walking my kids to school and nursery respectively. What was I saying to them? And every single sentence started with don't, or can you please, or something that was basically like a euphemism for fuck's sake, stop doing that. Uh-huh. And it's because, obviously, we take it as a given. It's granted, we love our children, we die for them and everything else. At the moment, my six-year-old's a bit of an asshole. Yeah, like, he's just, his thing is like, he makes stupid noises. He doesn't listen when I ask him to stop. Yeah. It's not funny. And there's no way of controlling him because I don't believe in domestic violence. What do I do? So I'm like, this is the thing that I'm constantly just disciplining him, and I hate myself for it.
You hear yourself doing it. That'll happen. And there's this thing, isn't there? Don't do that because you will get hit by a car. Don't do that because you will cut your finger. This thing of saying that will definitely happen. Yeah. And that, of course, then you're like, oh God, I'm just giving them massive anxiety.
Yeah, I've been doing that for years. And we're in a good phase at the moment. I will enjoy listening back to this because I've come out of two different phases of him being really, really hard work and really highly strung and treating every interjection as a huge start of a fight and just being mean and all the rest of it. I obviously am kind of cloud nine at the moment. We're in a really, really good rut. Phase.
Testosterone rushes,
isn't it? Get squirts of testosterone into their head and they drive them mad. We're all men. Mm. We know what it's like to be mad because of the testosterone. Mm. He gets that and he's got no idea how to cope with it.
In my eldest kid, I see him. He walks along swinging his shoulders and I'm like, he's having a growth spurt. There's testosterone going on there. He's just got a different approach to everything.
I've never thought about it.
And it lasts a week or so and then he calms down a bit.
This is to do with relating to myself. I feel like someone who's been influenced by testosterone a huge deal in my life.
But do you not remember, like, as a teenager, just sometimes feeling mental or feeling so horny you feel mad, or like just getting so angry you've got to go out in the garden and smash
it's all hormones,
things
isn't it? It's all hormones.
Have you seen Rushmore?
Yes, not for a
that
while.
Was me.
Okay, yeah, fine. Yeah. Well, I think this is the difference in terms of, like, we've spent, myself and Tom have spent years doing comedy shows, talking about ourselves, investigating ourselves, and kind of, you know, therapizing ourselves by doing it. I'm not sure that you've had quite the same approach to your
self-investigation. No, but it's a really relevant point. You know? It might be hormonal, and I maybe should be more permissive. But I can't have him continuing making that noise when I've asked him to stop making that noise.
I'm thoroughly enjoying, though, the idea of what it is you say most often to the kids. You really painted a picture there that I totally relate to, just walking along. And the verbals, man, they're always the same. The way I speak to the boys, I might say, don't do that, or this will happen. And also the everything in my house comes through me, daddy. The whole thing is like I'm in charge of. I help with IT stuff, I help building stuff, I help if we're going to play cricket out in the street. Like, it all comes through me. Often for big stints of the day, often in the evening, just before bedtime or whatever. And I just hear myself going, yeah, okay. Oh, that's my, like the one I always use when they go, daddy, that's my name. Like, I hear myself saying, that's my name. Come on, what is it? You know,
hey, that's what horses eat.
The major problem I've got to now, and this is a really, you know, if I could hear this when I was recording this podcast years ago, I would have danced with joy. It feels like when they got to this age, I can go for an hour and a half without being needed. And then it's full sprint doing everything for half an hour. And it's that changing of gear. You know what I mean? That changing of pace. So when you've got a kid who's 2, 3, 4, you're just on the whole time. What are we doing? Let's go over here. Okay, this is happening. I might look at my phone a bit, but I'm kind of... Now they're 6 and 10 next week. It's like they're going to go upstairs for an hour and a half. I'm not needed. Mm. So then I've got me again. As you're saying, you get your life back, which is great. But then suddenly that breaks. Dunk, and you're back in the classic child
triage.
Scrape. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Someone shit themselves. Someone's got a bleeding finger. Absolutely standard stuff. Like, it is full A&E out of nowhere.
But it shouldn't be acting. What we're all kind of saying is, it is sort of act, like, you're like, oh,
okay. Acting.
Well, I have to play this part again. I have to be dad.
Oh, no, I don't feel like the playing part thing. I just mean, what I mean is... It isn't the playing part thing. I love doing that.
You mean
it's the shifting
rhythm,
in gears.
It's the abrupt gear
it's
change.
It's the abrupt, like...
Yeah, oh, but God. From yourself to what? You just said you were yourself when they're upstairs.
So
playing.
They're upstairs,
so then
and
what
I'm,
do you become?
Well, okay, not myself.
You're
I am
playing a part.
I am Tom doing emails. I'm Tom reading a book. And then right. I got going to be Tom being a dad.
Yeah, and Tom and being a dad is a part, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
it comes with
it
certain sort of
it is, but I'm so,
like, ethical and moral values and clear instructions
but I was,
that isn't real life.
I was so method in that part for the last, you know, 8 years or so. I think I've only just realised in the last year that was just a part that I would then go and do. Like, because it is. It's just a role in my life. And that role is, whether you like it or not, it does diminish after those first few years. There's bigger challenges ahead, of course. But in the instant of having a 6 and a 10-year-old, you can get a good hour and a half off or 2 hours where you're just not needed. I can be doing my own thing. And they're downstairs and they're happy and they're playing with each other or whatever, and suddenly it's full on making food or whatever it is, and I love it. I absolutely love it. But that changing gear is very, very difficult.
I really appreciate those moments when, like, a couple of times I've heard myself saying, that is a really big question. Like last night I put him into bed, they sleep in the same room and they're both knackered, so he says, I do worry about death. We'd gone through the splinter saga and he was worried about it getting infected, and I think there was a sort of sideline of, oh, what if that kills me? You know, but it wasn't stated. And I felt very good saying, that's a really big conversation. I really want to have that with you, but not just now. Mm. And I walked out of the room feeling like a parent. Hastily Googling, talk to kids about death. You know?
But that's a good technique. We should talk about that, but not now. Yeah,
talk about
really,
it, but not
that's
now.
Straightforward answer.
100%. That's really important, and you're really... I'm really impressed and excited that you're thinking about that. Mm. And sometimes I don't even know the answer, but let's learn it together.
It's a good radio trick. I use it on my magic show all the time. Go on. We'll talk about that after this from Phil Collins.
Last few years, we haven't been able to have birthday parties for our kids because COVID, etc.
Yep.
This January, we did a party. We invited the whole class.
Oh, yeah, you do. For my youngest, at 6, you still do the... Everyone come. Just everyone come.
Yeah. We're the only ones to have done it, still. This isn't me
this
complaining if anyone's
thing.
Listening from my school. But, like, no, we're the only... And I thought... I actually thought, you know what? We did a trampoline park thing.
Yeah.
So there was a cost. You know, each kid was, I don't know, 12 quid or something.
Did you charge it back to the parents?
But I was like, we haven't done a party for 3 years.
Yeah.
So let's just do it this one time. Let's invite the whole class.
16 leaders with whistles, thrashing around, blow a whistle every 8 minutes. Then into the party room. It stinks. Don't worry about it. 20 pieces arrive, UV lights, get out. Bang.
We're done. Wear the presents.
Go.
Bye-bye.
We did one of those. And it was fun, actually. I enjoyed it. And I got to know some of the other parents because they came and they had to hang around.
Yeah.
But I just thought that's interesting that no one else is doing it still.
We did ours. Of course, we got the kids on the same blooming birthday. Yeah, so I keep forgetting that. So, yeah, December, we did, we hired out a soft play for him and all his classmates. But it was different to when we used to do it with the eldest because all the parents didn't come. With my eldest, all the parents would come, we'd all hang out, and we really bonded. All the parents were still like thick as thieves for the first kid. I think this is quite common, but the second kid...
They want to throw him through the window, basically.
I just don't care, mate.
Drive away as soon as possible.
But also, when I'm meeting parents of friends of my second kid, who I don't know that well, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Whereas with the first kid, I was like, what's your name? Let's get your number.
Totally.
Stay in touch. With second kid parents, couldn't give a shit, mate.
Exactly that observation over the weekend. We went to a 4-year-old's birthday party that my daughter was invited to. My son went as well, so we went. And it was really funny going, I was chatting to two of the other parents of my son's age kids, going, hey, look, we're us now. We're the guys who don't, we're not needy, desperately running around trying to network and make friends with other parents because we're like, whatever, because we've already got our mates.
Because you
at
knew
us
some,
in a little knot. They hate us.
With the first kids, with the first kid and all the parent friends, you knew a few parent friends for whom their kid, it was their second kid, so they'd look at you in a kind of, I don't need you in my life.
Yeah, I don't need you.
You're not my priority. And maybe they were slightly older. Often the parents were a bit older, slightly different age. Whereas all the parents from my first kid, that were all about the same sort of age, were all kind of early 40s, late 30s. And for the second one, literally, there's like two or three really good friends, and the rest, I'm like, yeah, I'm not interested.
We did make a controversial-ish decision, though, which was that we weren't doing party bags. Now, that was a principle for me, partly environmental, partly budgetary. I was like, no, they're coming here, they're getting a piece of pizza, they're getting time on the trampoline, they don't need a plastic...
Piece of cake and a bit of napkin, hold it in your hand, get out.
Yes, exactly.
Get in the car.
That's increasingly the case now.
Is it?
Yes, I think, and a long time coming, thank goodness.
Because we were asked by a few mums that came to pick up their kid, having left them in our charge for 2 hours, are there party bags? Mm. And when we said, no, there aren't party bags, there was like this thing of like, I don't know how to respond to that answer.
Yeah. But where are the party bags?
We did, for the one we had in December, we did a big box. I say we, let's be honest, absolutely Beth did this. She made a massive box full of tiny little knickknacks that were wrapped up in paper. So they were, there was no plastic. And they were little
things.
Yeah,
we did environmental one this year.
Yeah, but because some of the things with my eldest, some of the parties that we used to go to, back in the day when we were killing the planet, luckily that's all been sorted now. But it was absurd. You get these little like penny whistles that were plastic or whatever, and he gave, and it would sort of,
and it'd fall apart instantly.
It would evaporate in his hands and it'd be on the floor within seconds. Brilliant.
Thanks for coming. Here's a bag of landfill.
That's a one-use whistle right there. Yeah. That is a disposable whistle is absurd.
Yeah.
It was week after week after week as well. It was ridiculous.
So it's the summer holidays now. Year two around the corner, implausibly, at primary school.
My eldest is going into year six now, so he's about to finish primary school.
Oh, wow.
I know, I'm absolutely devastated. It's just been the most magnificent chapter of my life. Like, I can't believe it's coming to an end. I love it so, so much. All the friends we've made and the relationships he's formed and watching him flourish, all these things.
The playground chats in the morning at drop-off set you up for the day. Love
it. That's the other thing as well. Sorry to tangent this as well, but my eldest wants to walk to school by himself, and he kind of can now.
Mm.
And why should I not let him do that? I mean, I will, but I will stalk him.
I still, we hold hands. I take my eldest to school and we hold hands.
Yeah,
and a lot of his mates are on scooters and don't hold hands. And I'm like, I should stop being available to hold his hand because I'm doing it for me.
My eldest did that. My youngest brother, who's the same age as yours, he as we got round towards the front of school, pulled his hand away for the first time the other day.
And I was like, I will weep in the street.
And I said, listen, if you don't want to hold my hand, that's fine. If you're embarrassed. And he just went, stop. Couldn't talk about it. I was like, mate. Don't worry, if you're embarrassed, I'm not going to be angry. Stop. Couldn't talk about it. Stop.
God. Like, we're in a really good phase at the moment. We're all getting on. At summer, that helps, you know, but it's just feeling like we've come out of the tunnel. I feel really good. I feel really happy about my life and how my family are kind of fitting into and have changed my career and everything. It's all coherent at the moment. I feel it's lovely to say all that out loud because it hasn't felt like that for a long time. My fears, my concerns are all to do with the external, with the outside world, with the environment, with, you know, and I it's one of those things that if I talk about it at any real length, I will sound a bit nuts because I think I'm becoming radicalized as an environmental person. So the fact that we are all still behaving as if our children's future is going to look anything like our present is really weird. And if I think about it for too long, I start flipping out. So I've got those concerns. I'm like, okay, what are the, to bring it to parenting, what are the best ways in which we can help our children survive an extremely uncertain future, not just environmentally, with the war in Ukraine, with what that means for China and whether China are going to have a pop at Taiwan and what that means for global stability or not. All of those things we could do without all of the kind of war and nationalism issues, because the environment is this phenomenal challenge that we are still not even really tackling or accepting.
Okay, so what's the answer to that?
Well, how do we prepare your kids? So the positive way, I think, to do it is there's the kind of the right-wing prepper and
sterilize them.
Yeah. Well, oh God, don't
teach
even.
Teach
don't
them
even.
Dentistry and
agriculture, animal husbandry, medicine, for sure, because things are going to crumble. You know, not in a wild-eyed, crazy way, but structures that we are completely used to are going to stop working over the course of the rest of our lives. They're going to stop working in the way that we are used to. So the right-wing prepper says, I'm going to buy my, you know, very, very broadly, says, I'm going to make a bunker and put all my stuff in and I'm going to live. And the left-wing prepper says, I'm going to activate in the community and I'm going to make sure that community groups, I'm going to make sure I know everyone on my street and we know everyone on the streets around, and we're going to prepare for the uncertainty of the future by mobilizing and becoming more able to look after each other, because that's going to become more of a thing, as we saw for moments during the pandemic. And wasn't it nice when we all had a street WhatsApp group and things like that? I think trying to, the idea that they have this phenomenal and radiant and perfect innocence at the moment, which is not just innocence about how horrible the world can be, but is also like, at least when I was a kid, I mean, I don't remember when I first found out about the possibility of nuclear war and that, how horrifying that would be, but I'm sure it took a toll on me. The idea that at some point before too long, because with the reading, he's reading books for 12-year-olds, basically. And so the content of them, we've got to be really, really careful, because there is some stuff in there that he can read all the words and understand a lot of them, but he's not ready for the stuff it brings up.
Yeah.
War, people running away from war. Ukraine happened. He said, Daddy, are we going to have to move away from our home? You know, and all this kind of stuff. The point at which we have to say, not only is the world a scary place and people can do mean things that up until now we've insulated from and pretended didn't happen, but also there is a bit of a downward curve. There's a potential, a fear of a kind of environmental cascade effect where it all stops working, and that will be really tragic. How do we prepare you for that? I've got absolutely no idea.
Well, it's an interesting thought, Stuart, and I'm very proud of you for thinking it, but we'll talk about it another day.
Here's Phil Collins.
Stuart Goldsmith and Tom Price. Do please, if you enjoyed that, check out their excellent podcasts as well. Stu's is called The Comedian's Comedian, in which he talks to stand-ups about their life's work. Tom's is called My Mate Bought a Toaster, in which he interviews celebs about their Amazon search history. Both shows are really funny, and having heard that conversation, it probably won't surprise you to know that as well as being very funny men themselves, they're also excellent interviewers. I'd really recommend both those shows. I've put links on our website. Do check them out. And the dads will return in 2023. But if that was enough to make you decide you don't ever want to be a parent ever, we'll be talking about a new contraceptive next. Alex Fox on Phexxi after this.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. It's spring. The sun is finally out. The daffodils are in bloom. I am so grateful at this time of year, even just picking my kids up from school, to be feeling that uplift in my mood. But then people try and talk to me. They'll say, "How are you?" And I'll suddenly think, "I don't know, because I don't speak to anybody. I sit in my office at home by myself, working from home. I'm not used to conversation." And suddenly, I feel a bit vulnerable. It might be you're the reverse. It might be that you're constantly going out and meeting people and talking to people, but then feel like you've drained your social battery and you just want more time to yourself.
In either case, that can put a bit of a downer on spring. And that is an example of where therapy can help to improve your self-awareness and build yourself a social life that won't drain your battery. And seriously, BetterHelp is the way to give therapy a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. And our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/man. That's better, HELP.com/MANN.
Time for the Foxhole, your sex questions answered with the wonderful Miss Fox. Hello, Alex.
Bonjour, which is what I'm going to say from now on if I get makey face while I'm giving a blowjob.
What have you been up to this month?
Well, last month we were talking about biodegradable sex toys.
We were.
This month, I'm getting myself a biodegradable tattoo.
Okay. I'm just scanning those words through my head. That's what this sound is. Isn't any sort of disposable tattoo, like non-permanent tattoo, a biodegradable tattoo? What's the difference?
These are made to fade. I'm getting it done at a place in Brooklyn called Ephemeral. And they're made with a special ink that is designed to only last 9 to 15 months, during which time it just gets lighter and lighter. That process, the speed of it depends on where you have the tattoo on your body. So if it's exposed to more sunlight, then it might fade a little bit faster. Depends on your own personal bodily chemical makeup, how much melanin you've got in your skin, but it will completely disappear in under 2 years.
Okay, so the difference is length, basically. So like, no, yes. But the ones that my six-year-old gets on his hands, they last for 5 days, right? So it's that, but it's 2 years.
Yeah, this isn't a stick-on thing.
Yeah,
or a transfer.
I know.
It's drilled into the top layer of the skin
to work
in
out
the
what
same
the
way
is.
That a normal
Fine.
Tattoo would be. But it's non-committal. So it's only going to be there for a little while.
Are you going to put your partner's name there, bearing in mind that in 2 years you've got another opportunity?
You know what? I really considered getting a mixture of traditional tattoo ink and Ephemeral ink and having the picture of Marty McFly from Back to the Future done so that over time he would disappear from my skin. But I'm actually having the words into thin air, so they will disappear into thin air because I cannot resist a pun. But I asked the person, Kate, who's doing my tattoo, whether people do get their names done. Mm. So, you know, so that they can go through all that kind of ritual and romanticism of having their partner inscribed on their body without worrying that if the relationship comes to an end, then they'll have to have it covered up. And she said, yeah, that it's really popular for that reason.
It's like a prenup, isn't it? In tattoo form. So you can have it outlined after 2 years or you can just let it disappear.
Well, some people have it done over and over again. So they'll commit to it for, you know, 15 months or so and then decide that they quite like it and they want to renew it for another 15 months. Which got me thinking about the potential of ephemeral tattoos for kinky reasons. Mm. And I asked my audience, you know, if you knew that it wasn't going to last forever, would you go through the kind of the thrill and the pain and the excitement of getting something like, for example, the word slave tattooed on you? Mm. So there were a big contingent who said, no, the excitement for me of getting a tattoo related to my fetish or what sexually turns me on is that it's there forever. You know,
yes.
It's not just about the pain of the process. It's the fact that, you know, I'm nailing my colours to the mast. Whereas other people said, yeah, I really like the idea that I'd be able to go through that and it would be very titillating without worrying that when I'm drawing my pension, it's going to say pervert across my buttocks or whatnot. And I did speak to some people who had tattoos, traditional ones, relating to their fetishes, who had really mixed views of them now, even though they meant a lot to them at the time.
Yes, exactly.
Some people really had regrets.
Is it literally in my entire wardrobe, there's one T-shirt that I've had for more than a decade. Everything else, at some point, I've been like, I don't look good in that anymore. I don't want it.
And a T-shirt is very, very different to having a lock and key relating to your partner's dominant status over you tattooed. Or one guy told me he has a wedgie fetish. He's really into hiring people to yank his underwear so far up his butt crack that it causes harm. And he's got massive block letters along his lower back saying wedgie me and a cartoon depiction of somebody being wedgied on his arm.
Right.
And while
But actually to do so would be an assault, wouldn't it? That doesn't count as consent, does it? Because someone's asking for it on a tattoo.
That's a really interesting idea, actually.
He's saying, in my fantasy, you would come up to me and wedgie me, but he's not actually prepared for someone to do that. I would argue. I've never met the man.
I'd like to speak to him about how he would react if someone did that unexpectedly in public and claimed that they were merely following instructions on his tattoos.
And I wouldn't, and that's what makes us different. It's time for our listener question of the month.
Our visits to Sainsbury's are very desperate.
And it comes from Nelle, who says, I apologise, by the way, if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly there, N-E-L-E. I have been married for 11 years, and after having two kids, I don't want to go back on the pill. Alex, have you heard about Phexxi? P-H-E-X-X-I. I am interested in your opinion about this new, contraception method.
This is a really brilliantly timed question because it is relatively new. It's been on the market for about 2 years. Hmm. And
as long as a temporary tattoo. Time to review.
So Phexxi is a non-hormonal form of female contraception. It's used on a case-by-case basis. So you just use it just prior to having sex, and then it's flushed out of the body. So so it's only temporary.
And use it where?
Well, it's...
You stick it in a thing, or do you drink it?
No, please don't drink it. although I'm reliably informed that for most people it doesn't have any taste, but for some people it has a mild hint of either vinegar or lemon. And this is relevant because it's a gel mixture of lactic acid, citric acid and potassium bitartrate, which comes in a little syringe form, and you inject it up into the vaginal cavity just prior to having sex.
Wow.
So you might taste it if oral is part of your sexual experience.
Although it's right up there, right? It's not on the external facing bits generally.
No, but it might drip down.
It might drip down.
Although it's quite viscous. So the way it works is the normal pH of a woman's vagina is somewhere between 3.5 and 4.5. And when semen enters, that changes the pH. It soars up to around 7 or 8. Phexxi helps keep that pH more acidic, more in that range of 3.5, 4.5. Whereas a spermicide would kill the sperm, Phexxi just maintains the acidic environment of the vagina. As a result, it can be less harsh on a woman's body than a spermicide.
How convenient is it to get it?
You do need to get it on prescription, currently only in the USA. And I spoke to the CEO of the company that make it. And she was telling me how, because the way the American healthcare system works with insurance, usually you need to make sure that your insurer will cover the cost of something like Phexxi in order to make it affordable. Otherwise, it's close to £400 for just 12 of these little syringes, which isn't, which isn't
considerably more than
for
a condom.
Most people. Yeah, considerably more than a condom. Thankfully, more insurers now are covering it. So in 2021, around 55% of insurance companies would cover this. Now it's more like 75%, and that is expected to grow because it's 93% effective, trials have shown, when it's used perfectly at preventing pregnancy. It's 86% effective with typical use because people don't always follow instructions bang to the letter. Those kind of statistics are comparable with other more mainstream forms of contraceptive
on the market. And it doesn't have the hormonal effects and side effects.
And it doesn't have the hormonal effects.
Although a lot of women actually take the pill because it has hormonal effects, don't they?
Yeah, some people actively choose hormonal contraceptive because it can have useful side effects like helping to clear up acne, for example, or regulating periods. But on the flip side, lots of women find that for them, they claim that it affects their moods negatively, or it can increase the risks of certain cancers. If you have a particular cancer, you may be told by your doctor that you can't take hormonal contraception.
And then the thing about this case-by-case basis use, I mean, I know that, you know, in a long-term relationship especially, and we've talked on the show before about diarising sex as well, it doesn't have to be unromantic, etc. But the reality is, if it's like a spontaneous moment, carving out that 5 minutes where you're going to go to the bathroom and inject your fanny does ruin the mood a bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think once you practice, no more so than a condom,
okay,
you just shoot it up there as you would an applicator tampon.
Okay.
And it also, very interestingly, for 88.7% of women who were trialed, they said that Phexxi increased or maintained their sexual satisfaction, which certainly can't be said or isn't said by a lot of people of contraceptives like condoms. Part of the reason for that is that many women found it empowering to be able to just hit it and quit it with their contraception like this, knowing that it wasn't going to have any long-term systemic or hormonal effect. And secondly, because it is this kind of bioadhesive gel, while it's designed to mainly stay in place up inside the vagina, it does supply some lubricating effect. Also, there are currently additional trials underway to see whether Phexxi can get approved for a secondary use on the basis that it's showing real hope that it may be able to have some power preventing the spread of chlamydia and gonorrhea. So far, what they've found has been really, really encouraging. I would say to people, go and look at the specifics of these medical trials. They need to be approached with a healthy degree of interrogation, that there are somewhat context specific. But in summary, they found that there was a 50% reduction in the chance of contracting chlamydia when people using Phexxi as in their test groups as instructed, and a 79% reduction in gonorrhea. Phexxi doesn't 100% prevent the spread of these STIs, but it looks like it's going to give a lot more protection than any other form of contraceptive apart from condoms.
Okay, if you have a question of sex for Alex to answer in a future edition of the show, what do you have to do with it?
Load it into a syringe and then splurt it all over modernman2ends.co.uk after hitting feedback.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this episode of The Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new ambassador, and it's Hilary Suwin, a suburban mom from Delaware in the United States, who put herself forward for an ambassadorship when we had Claire Pooley on the show talking about mums who drink. That was back in 2020. I'm really sorry, Hilary, that it's taken me so long to get around to the shout-out, but we do only come out monthly. There is a waiting list. But your time has come. Assuming you're still alive, I now pronounce you Mambassador for Delaware. You get the whole state. That's not bad. If you'd like to be a Mambassador, then buy us a beer, drop us a line. Links on the website. Until next time, our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill, and we'll see you with something new on September the 10th. Scatter the dark.